The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
The place is packed. Where's Nock?
I gave him the night off.
What?
He's studying for his Starfleet exams.
He's a very dedicated student.
He's a disgrace to his family and to Ferengi everywhere. He should be here, helping us earn profit, not in his room learning how to be more like a human.
He doesn't want to be human, brother. He just wants to join Starfleet.
It's the same thing. Don't you see? That's how it begins. All it takes is for one impressionable youngster to join Starfleet, and the next thing you know, a whole generation of Ferengi will be courting the Prime Directive and abandoning the pursuit of Latinum. It's the end of Ferengi civilization as we know it, and it's all your fault.
Relax, brother. Nog isn't going to destroy the Ferengi way of life. He just wants a job with better hours.
Welcome, everyone. It is Thursday, October 19th, 2023. I'm Bob Metz.
And I'm Robert Vaughn.
And this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right wing. It's just right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Mixing cultures won't be the end of civilization, but multiculturalism surely will be. Our good friend and frequent guest, Salim Mansour, has been calling it a delectable lie, which is also the title of the book he wrote to repudiate that lie and to distinguish the benign and beneficial mixing of cultures with the social cancer of multiculturalism. So get ready for an eye-opening and definitive discussion about the delectable lie of multiculturalism and how this collectivist ideology is a major driving force behind the destruction of Western civilization now being experienced both at home and abroad. In conversation with Robert Vaughn, The Great Awakening continues. Right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org, hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave, follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible.
In a recent speech to the American Enterprise Institute, UK Home Secretary Suella Braverman said that the policy of multiculturalism has failed. And I quote, "Uncontrolled immigration, inadequate integration, and a misguided dogma of multiculturalism have proven a toxic combination for Europe over the past few decades." Afterwards, she said, quote, "We have a great multi-ethnic society, and in many parts of our country, integration has worked, but there are also many towns and cities around the UK where it hasn't, and communities are living parallel lives. They are coming from abroad, they are not learning the language, they're not embracing British values, and they're not taking part in British life. We need to be fearless in calling that out," unquote. Now, this sentiment was also expressed back in 2010 by German Chancellor Angela Merkel and France's Emmanuel Macron. And yet the failed policy of multiculturalism prevails to this day. With us today is Professor Salim Mansour of Western University, who has written an award-winning book on multiculturalism, published in 2011 and called Delectable Lie, A Liberal Repudiation of Multiculturalism, which, by the way, is available on Amazon. Salim, your thoughts on what Suella Braverman has said?
Bravo, Braverman. Bravo. But it is bravo, and yet it is too late. It is as if, you know, in the proverbial metaphor, trying to close the barn door when all the cows have gone away. Angela Merkel, before she imported the migrants in the wake of Arab Spring in 2011-12, she opened the door and demanded all the European countries to accept migrants from the global south, that is, the greater Middle East, Africa, and so on and so forth. And then David Cameron, when he was the prime minister, talking in the same way that multiculturalism has failed. So we have people like Sula Braverman now saying the same thing that was said more than a decade ago, decade and a half ago. Multiculturalism was designed to fail in the following sense. It has failed the founding culture of the North American society and European society, the classical liberal culture value. First of all, both Europe and to that extent North America, plus South America, is part of the Christian world. It is Christendom in that classic historic sense. And there may be and there are people of background or faith tradition who are not Christians, or Christians who are no longer Christians. You know, they've gone whatever direction they seek to go. But the founding culture was part of Christendom. Multiculturalism has failed that culture, and has failed that culture by design, because multiculturalism as a policy, as a doctrine, as an ideology, was fabricated in this culture that was once a Christian culture, culture of liberal democracy. And Canada is a pioneer country. The idea of multiculturalism was first pronounced and put in play right here in Canada, in the Canadian Parliament, during the years before the celebration of Canada's first centenary, 1867, centenary year 1967. Prior to that centenary year, the Liberal government of Prime Minister Lester Pearson launched, in the context of Canada's own history, the Bilingual Bicultural Commission, the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism, in 1963. And eventually it was adopted. The policy of bilingualism and biculturalism became the official policy of Canada, that Canada is a bilingual country. By 1967, it was adopted in celebrating the centenary year. That is, Lester Pearson's gift to Canada was that we pulled down the Canadian traditional flag that had flown through 1867 into the centenary year, the Union Jack, and we had the new flag, the maple leaf. It is in during that debate and a commission hearing that went right across the country, the immediate context for the Bilingual Bicultural Commission was the stirrings that had all the potential of going violent with what was happening in Quebec, the Quiet Revolution that began prior to the Second World War, but accelerated after 1945 in Quebec. And to accommodate or to put a sort of a new social contract, political contract in the two culture, the two founding culture, the culture of the French, which was the Nouveau France in Lower Canada, and the culture of the English that defeated the French in the Plains of Abraham in 1759, and Canada became British North America, part of British North America. So to bring together again, or to refresh again, the old contract between English and French as part of the British Empire, B&B Commission, one can see, was put into effect. And the conclusion of the B&B Commission was that Canada is going to be a bilingual country and is a bicultural country. And that's well and good. That was the domestic consensus. That was the program that was initiated and implemented. But during that debate and the hearings, because this was a cross-country hearings of the B&B Commission, then when the B&B Commission went to the western provinces, to Manitoba, to Saskatchewan, to Alberta, there they heard the argument that Canada is not simply bicultural or bilingual, that there are other European cultures that came and settled Western Canada as the prairie provinces were demarcated. First was Manitoba, and then was Saskatchewan and Alberta in 1905, and a plurality, if not majority, of the people in the prairie provinces were neither English nor French. They were Germanic, people of German origin, people of Slav origin, Russian origin, like the Dukhobors. And so they needed to be recognized, and their identity, their culture needed to be also acknowledged into this mosaic of a country, and that the word mosaic very much came into effect. We had books like The Vertical Mosaic that was written in the context of the BNB Commission report. And for a long time, Vertical Mosaic was the standard textbook in colleges and university, in Canadian sociology, in Canadian political science. So the man who pushed hardest on this line of argument for the people in the prairie provinces was Senator Paul Yuzik, a progressive conservative senator. Paul Yuzik was of Ukrainian origin, born in Canada, of Ukrainian parents. And he argued that Canada should recognize the non-French and non-English population and their culture. And in that context, the Pearson government more or less agreed. And so Paul Yuzik becomes the father of multiculturalism.
Is there anything fundamentally wrong with his thesis that, yes, perhaps back in 1867, when the three provinces of Canada, New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, formed Canada, it was primarily, almost exclusively, English-French. And of course, with a very small population of Aboriginals. However, you know, we were talking about a parliamentary system, and the English and the French were it. So when we expanded in 1905, for example, with Alberta, and took in an area that had a lot of non-English or non-French ethnicities versus cultures, there is a difference. We can get into that. Then is what Yuzik saying so out of the ordinary that, yes, we were English and French, now we're multicultural?
Well, I mean, whether it is right or wrong can only be seen in the effects of ideas. Ideas come out in abstraction, you might say, you know, and then those abstract ideas are turned into policies, and they impact on the life of a people, of a nation, of a country. So a judgment upon whether it was good or bad in the abstraction, you know, fine, but it is in the effect. And that's where Suella Braverman, which is the mother country for Canada, by the way, and the English Parliament is the mother parliament for Canada, not for America. America broke away. That was the American Revolution, 1776. Though America is the largest English-speaking country if we discount India. Because ironically, India is the largest speaking English country. America is the largest, most powerful English-speaking country. But Americans are not all Englishmen. In fact, the English in America is a minority. The majority in America are the Hispanics, or is becoming the majority. So, yes, I mean, this is something that a royal commission at the taxpayers' expense, initiated by the Prime Minister and the Parliament of Canada, with commissioners appointed by the government who are technically supposed to be the experts on these matters. It was for them, in the abstraction, to work out the consequences of their ideas, both the positive and the negative, because any idea, when implemented, will have unintended consequences, and the unintended consequences are the negative consequences, you know. So in the abstract, when Paul Yuzik argued in 1963 for the recognition of other cultures that were neither French nor English, they were arguing for some sort of a mosaic that would be our identity as a country. Well, America is a mosaic in terms of identity, Robert. The Americans are a melting pot of identities. It is a melting pot of identities, that is cultural identities, of Americans who come from all over the world. And the very founding value of America in that term is e pluribus unum, from many one. So irrespective of whether you're German-American or Hungarian-American or Chinese-American, Japanese-American, Indo-American, whatever, from the 360-degree point of angle of the world, the circle, you're coming into America, you become an American. You can cook your own cuisine, dress your own dress, dance your own dance, play your own music, speak your own language at home, have your own community newspapers and magazine in all the languages of the world. I believe in the school board of New York City, the district of New York City, there's something like 160 languages that the children come from. But they all are at least taught to learn English. English is the language of America. There have been efforts to introduce into America Hispanic as the second language, but that has been repeatedly turned down. You know, that doesn't mean Hispanic language has been turned down. It is Hispanic as an official language has been turned down.
Isn't that the salient feature of multiculturalism that we want to get into here, Salim? And that is that in the United States, we call it a melting pot. And a lot of Canadians have disparaged that term, thinking that, oh, you're going to have to give up your culture to become American, right? Which is not the case.
Not the case.
Of course, as you say, you can still practice all of those aspects of your culture from the home country, the fatherland, wherever that you want. You are free in America. Freedom of expression, freedom of speech. You can do and say what you like in that mm-hmm. regard. The one thing that you cannot do, and this I think is key, is that, and you hit upon it when you said that the official language of the United States, even though it is not enshrined as official, is English. And that means that the law is in English. It is not translated. It is English. And so you may be a Ukrainian American or a Korean American, et cetera, ad nauseum, but we are all agreed upon as Americans. I mean, we're in Canada. As Americans, they are all agreed upon that the law is the same for everybody and nobody is singled out as special or inferior, while in Canada, that is not the case. We have two laws. Civil law in Quebec is Napoleonic Code. Civil law elsewhere in the country is common law. In Quebec, in the federal government, we have our laws translated, English and French. There's no single official language, so there's often confusion there. We give deference to Quebec. They have an overrepresentation in the Supreme Court. We give deference to other cultures because now, because of our multicultural policy, we actually support with funds from every other culture, ethnic events and cultures from the Kalistani to the Ukrainians. And our constitution is a hodgepodge, a mixed bag, which Canada cannot survive because of this.
Those are all the unintended consequences part of the discussion. You know, that was going to happen. That was bound to happen. That's what Suella Braverman or Angela Merkel or David Cameron, after having adopted multiculturalism as a policy that was initiated in Canada, now they are scratching their head. What are they going to do? Now the problem has become massive. But the problem should have been understood at its inception. I think where I would differ with you, Robert, is when you start making the point about language, two language, English and French, Napoleonic Code in terms of law in Quebec, common law in English Canada. So those are all water under the bridge. Those are nice academic discussion that we can have. But the point is that in 1759, the Parliament of England, in making laws for British North America, provided for, accepted both French language, French religion, that is Catholicism, the English were Protestant, you know, or Anglican. I mean, the Church of Henry VIII had been established in 1500s. So there was that accommodation that the British North America would be of two people.
Now, one of the more remarkable speeches at last week's Tory Party conference was made by the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, in which she talked about luxury beliefs which is a phrase I believe coined by Rob Henderson, the American academic. But it's also something that our next guest, Matt Goodwin, talks about. Matt has a new book called Values, Voice, and Virtue. And Matt, you've written quite a lot about this subject. Can you define for us, first of all, for anyone who hasn't heard the term before, what luxury beliefs are and why they represent an opportunity for the Tory party?
Luxury beliefs are really about the sort of hypocrisy that lie at the heart of some people in the elite. And for the Conservative Party, when it comes to issues like migration, diversity, identity, family, crime, some prominent politicians, Suella Braverman included, clearly think that there's some political capital to be had by zooming in on some of those contradictions. You know, look, since the Brexit referendum, we were often told that voters don't really care about these issues around immigration and identity anymore. Well, we know that that's not true. We know that, for example, migration, both legal and illegal, is back to being the third most important issue for all voters and the most important issue for those 2019 Conservative voters who only last week rated it above the economy, which is really quite remarkable when you consider we're in the most severe cost of living crisis for half a century. If you look at the issues that we often refer to as quote unquote culture wars, these issues are often actually very central to the way in which people think about their lives. So immigration is a great example. About 75% of people would like to lower overall migration. They think it's been too high over the last decade. You know, Suella Braverman, what she said, and I've polled it, is very popular in the country. 66% of all Brits think that mass immigration is an existential challenge to the West.
Now, in America, there was also that culture. The French were not simply on the Laurentian Valley, that's Lower Canada. The French were also in the Mississippi Valley. That's the Louisiana Purchase of 1804 by Jefferson, when Napoleon disinherited France by giving up the Louisiana, which was a French port in the Gulf. So in pursuit of his European wars, Napoleon sold his French heritage, right? And as a result, the United States of America became primarily English, you know? Now just do a thought experiment. If the Louisiana Purchase had not taken place, and Louisiana Purchase was accommodated in some sort of a contractual agreement, which is what happened after 1759 in British North America on the Laurentian Valley, then America could have been a bilingual country. So again, history moves on. America became an English-speaking country. But Canada, from 1759 onwards, was a contractual agreement of English and French. And of course, that conflict at the micro level has played out in Canadian history. Remember, Louis Riel was hanged for demanding French education rights and religious rights in the Rupert lands, which became Manitoba. So even in this terms of the two linguistic history, the two cultural history as founding culture, there have been conflicts. And the Bilingual Bicultural Commission of 1963 by Lester Pearson was inaugurated, conceptualized, and pushed forward because of the gathering steam of the Quiet Revolution that had the potential of breaking out in violence. And it did break out in violence. That was the FLQ conflict of 1970 that led to the first implementation by the Trudeau family, father and son, of the War Measures Act. So those are all the backstory behind this. But the point is, where does multiculturalism come in? Well, the argument for multiculturalism came in from the Western Prairie provinces. And the father of multiculturalism, for our discussion and for historical purposes, is Senator Paul Yuzik, a Ukrainian-Canadian who asked for the recognition of the non-French, non English cultures of the prairie provinces. And by the way, all of those non-English and non-French culture of the prairie provinces were primarily, in terms of majority, European in origin. Except for those Chinese that had been brought into Canada to work and build the railways, to build and unite Canada. All of the others in the prairie provinces are immigrants and migrants that have come from Europe. And that's what Senator Paul Yuzik is asking for, you know, and that is accepted in the sense of a policy, but not constitutionally, because we are a bilingual and a bicultural country, English and French. Our parliament established that. So where did the demand of Paul Yuzik go? The demand of Paul Yuzik had a second life. And that second life happens when Prime Minister Lester Pearson is gone, Pierre Trudeau becomes a leader, he wins his first election with a majority government in the 1968 election. But when he goes for the second round of election in 1972, when he calls the election, the majority government dissolves into a minority government, and Trudeau is in a shock. He doesn't understand how come he lost his majority. But it is in that context of the minority government of Pierre Elliott Trudeau that Pierre Elliott Trudeau plays the card of multiculturalism by recognizing that Canada, unlike United States, is a cultural mosaic and that we are a multicultural country. And he is going to appeal to Canadians in a hyphenated terms. And so the multicultural policy was adopted by the government, for the government to push it. It was not a sort of a statutory or a constitutional adoption. That would come later. So the push began, and with the push, the open-door immigration that began in the late 60s, and Canada started evolving in a direction, the mosaic, and not as a salad bowl, and not as a melting pot. Right? Prime Minister Trudeau's multicultural policy was then given a statutory position by Brian Mulroney when he passed the Multicultural Act. And that statute, the basis of that statute, was then brought into the Charter of Rights and Freedom, Section 27, when the BNA Act was patriated in 1982. With the Charter of Rights and Freedom attached to it. And so we officially, constitutionally, became a multicultural country. Now we can talk about it. What is its effect? How has it played out? And what it means for us as Canadians?
Let me quote to you some, going back to Suella Braverman, some quotes that could be germane to this discussion. She says that it is a basic rule of history that nations that cannot defend its borders will not long survive. And uncontrolled immigration, inadequate integration, and a misguided dogma of multiculturalism have proven a toxic combination for Europe over the past few decades. It failed because it allowed people to come into our society and live parallel lives in it. It has been too much, too quick, with too little thought given to integration and the impact on social cohesion. So I think that we're seeing this happen in Canada. I think that it certainly changes the face of this country politically. It's okay to love the country that you were born into or that your parents came into. But when it comes to politics, that's what we're talking about, isn't it, Salim?
Yeah. See, we're talking about multiculturalism, and Suella Braverman is talking about multiculturalism. She's saying that the policy has failed. The fundamental question is why? And what is multiculturalism? Because none of these people are defining multiculturalism. Even in Charter of Rights and Freedom, Section 27, multiculturalism is not defined. What is meant by multiculturalism?
Suella Braverman touches upon a definition when she says that we are multi-ethnic, and there's nothing wrong with that, but multicultural is different. So she touches upon the term ethnic versus culture, which I think is very important.
Right. The point is, multiculturalism doesn't mean multi-ethnic. Multiculturalism has a very specific meaning, and it was not defined, and it remains undefined. People do understand what it means instinctively, but we're talking about getting into law, constitution, in our case, the Charter of Rights and Freedom. What is meant by multiculturalism? My book, Delectable Lie, was precisely taking apart as an academic and a legal and a constitutional discussion what is to be meant by multiculturalism. And I called it a delectable lie. Now look, Robert, America is multicultural too, but America does not use that term. In terms of First Amendment right, America is profoundly multicultural. You know, you could just walk into New York or go anywhere in the large metropolitan cities and you see the whole range of cuisine, art, music, dress, people. It's multicultural in that sense, you know, but it is not recognized legally or constitutionally. America is e pluribus unum, that is, it is a multi-ethnic country. You don't have to be a blonde, blue-eyed, white, Anglo-Saxon, or Germanic American to be an American, and the rest are all then untermenschen. No? You are American from wherever it comes, and that was established and proven. Politically, people are debating that ever since. But when in 2008 election, Obama, whose birth we don't know where he is from, the first black man becomes America's president. Right? It is a highly disputed thing that has happened in American politics. But constitutionally, nobody had been able to challenge that fact. And he was not only elected in 2008 with a majority, he was re-elected in 2012. So that issue is over. And now we have the vice president, like Suella Braverman, of Indian origin. Her father is from the Caribbean and her mother is from South India, right? So Kamala Harris is a multicultural identity right in your face, as was Obama, as I am, as you are, as a newfie Canadian, you know, but it was not defined. And when you cannot define it, or you don't want to define it, is because you don't have any standard of measuring. Multiculturalism, in effect, in policy term, means all cultures have to be treated equally. Just as in terms of multi-ethnic, every individual is to be treated equally, irrespective of what is your ethnic background. So we are individuals, but we are individuals from different ethnic backgrounds or mixed ethnic backgrounds. And as individuals, the law, the Constitution, recognizes the right. So the fundamental basis of the American Constitution, and which was the fundamental basis of the Canadian DNA Act, is that everyone is equal before the law individually, right? That's the fundamental issue.
So I don't buy the argument that, you know, so-called culture wars, which, by the way, you know, these issues are often foundational to who we are, the rights of family, the rights of women, sex-based rights, history, identity. You know, this is all pretty central stuff. I don't think you can just push this out of politics. I think this is now in the center of politics and in the public square. Voters are very disillusioned across the board. I recently polled a big nationally representative sample of voters, and I asked them, what are the issues that you feel really concerned about, but also feel you're not represented on? Number one was immigration. Most people want it lowered. Most people want it slowed down. Neither of the parties are committed to that. Number two was political correctness. People feeling like they cannot say what they think. Neither party is seriously committed to rooting out this sort of stifling, you know, progressive ideology, so-called progressive ideology in the institutions, which has left so many people feeling as though they can't really say what they want to say. And the third was promoting Britain's distinctive identity, history, and culture against what many people feel is a sort of bland globalization, universal liberal ideology that sort of celebrates diversity, but isn't really all that interested in the distinctive things about Britain, the things that make us British or English or Welsh or Scottish. And those are the things that people really do feel animated about. And all politics is about supply and demand. And I think in Britain, what we've got at the moment is actually lots of public demand for a different kind of politics, but we don't have much supply.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. and our conversation with Salim Mansour continues.
So in terms of multiculturalism, it remains undefined, and it is that all cultures are equal. All cultures are equal. You ask the question, by what objective standard? And there is no answer. So it's all subjective. So whether we are multiculturally all equal, the culture of Taliban, how do we judge? How do we appreciate and say, yes, it is all equal? So we cannot be making any sort of discrimination. Discrimination not in terms of bigotry, but discrimination in terms of standards in application of law, because all cultures are equal. The culture of Mohawk Indian is equal to the culture of the Anglo-German people who put man on the moon. And that's the problem. And Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who people considered, and he himself considered, to be a philosopher king in a Platonic sense. He was a philosopher. He was a jurisprudent. He was a Harvard man. For him, who would dice and slice every word given his background. And that's why he's the father of the Constitution. He was the king in that final roundtable conference when everybody else and Mr. Peckford, who's the last remaining member of that 11, will have a hard time acknowledging the fact that Mr. Trudeau just played them and made them sign a document which he knew was full of contradictions. The Charter of Rights and Freedom now, we know, on the 40th anniversary of its patriation in 2022, on the 40th anniversary, we learned that it means nothing. And it means nothing as his son officially declared, Justin Trudeau, that Canada is a post-national state with no core identity. There you have it. When you cannot define something, it has no identity.
So, Salim, would that then explain why somebody like a Trudeau would applaud a Nazi, an actual living Nazi, in the parliament, which he did just a few weeks past?
Exactly. And so that's where we have
all our cultures are equal.
Exactly. Because as I use the word discrimination, discrimination is a perfect word when you're trying to understand our life. We discriminate in terms when you go to buy a car, whether I should buy a Honda or whether I should buy a BMW. We discriminate when we're trying to go to a restaurant. Do we want to eat a Mandarin Chinese food or we want to go and have an Italian pasta, you know, in terms of our taste bud, in terms of our liking? We discriminate on music. We discriminate on reading material and so on and so forth. But the word discrimination in terms of multiculturalism has been turned into a term of bigotry.
With one exception, Salim, and I think this is demonstrable, that the culture of white British men is discriminated against tacitly by the federal government, where you can see sometimes when they post for a job, English-speaking white men need not apply.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The Anglo-Saxons are now the target population in terms of ethnicity, ironically, in the West. So could it be that none of the native-born, native-stock English men and women in the British Parliament would dare to say what Suella Braverman said? Because they would immediately be shouted down as racist.
It is only because I think that she's of Indian heritage, even though she was born in London.
But she's ethnically not English.
Ethnically, yes, but I think that if you told her that she wasn't English, that she wasn't British,
she would agree with it. She's not blind to the fact.
Yeah.
What was, in terms of the founding ethnicities of people in the 13 colonies in the making of the United States of America after 1776, what was the largest ethnic background? The largest ethnic background was from the British Isles and people of Germanic background. So coming back to it, it doesn't matter, because the world is naturally, by its objective reality, multi-ethnic. The world is also multicultural in that objective way, but multicultural within a jurisdiction, that is the state, means, which was never defined in the case of Canada, or in the case of England, or in the case of Germany, as they adopted multicultural policies, that all cultures are equal within that jurisdiction. All cultures being equal within that jurisdiction means that you have to now coexist with cultures that are contradictory to each other. In the broadest sense, I was asked on at least two occasions to be an expert witness on this very discussion in the Parliament at the Committee for Multiculturalism and Citizenship. So I pointed out that the effect of multiculturalism, all cultures being equal, is the mixing of liberal culture, the founding culture of Canada, which is classical liberal culture, with illiberal cultures. Illiberal cultures are far more in numbers than the liberal culture, which is singular, the founding culture of Canada. And as I said to the honorable members of the parliament, when I was being questioned about this, I said, the result is precisely what happens when you start adding water to a bottle of wine. A point comes when it is no longer wine. It can be something else, but it's not wine. So that point has been made by the current prime minister. We have no core identity. The wine has no core identity anymore after you keep on adding water to it.
But he seems to say that this is a good thing.
Well, okay, fine. I mean, that's a judgment, right? Suella Braverman and others are making that judgment now, that the coherent identity of a country like Britain, based upon the majority of the people are Anglican Christian, the majority of the people are English speaking, the majority of the people are ethnically Caucasian, that is no longer true. And England is more or less losing its identity. If not, it has already lost it. In Canada, the same process is underway. That is the process that is underway in the United States under democratic government, the open borders, which is exactly what Suella Braverman is pointing out. The dominant effect of all cultures are equal is the normalization of those cultures that are illiberal. All cultures that are basically grounded upon some variation of collectivism is in opposition to that culture which celebrates individual rights.
And so they are collectivists, they're tribal. They have grown up of thousands of years understanding that the individual is subservient to the state or the tribe or whoever is at the top. While here we have a very entrenched notion that can only come from an upbringing, from an immersion and an integration of history, that the individual is an end unto himself. Is this what you're talking about, illiberal?
The birth of the culture of enlightenment, which has a very narrow foundation in terms of its birth. Philosophically, it seeks to be universal. The very first expression of the enlightenment culture in political term is the making of the United States of America. This is a unique culture in that sense. This is no longer taught in American and Canadian schools. I was a professor and a member, a tenured member, faculty member for four decades in one of the premier Canadian universities. It's only few of us in the university that talk about this because we have become a collectivist country.
The difference I see between the United States and Canada in this regard is why they were very slow in changing into a multicultural, globalist philosophy at the top, which they now have, was that they have a lot of stories. Mind you, they're 9-10 times bigger than Canada, but they had stories of bravery and of freedom and of individualism, and they idolized their founding fathers, and they wrote stories about them, which they taught in school. I don't remember ever reading about Canadian founding fathers. I bet you if you ask anybody out there other than Joey Smallwood, they'd never be able to say who a Canadian founding father is.
Our stories in Canada is the story of Anne of Green Gables that our children read in grade 2, 3 as they begin. Our children don't read the stories of Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death, you know. So British North America split as a result of 1776.
But the person out there on the street, it's almost like you see the man on the street interviews in the United States on July 4th. Why are we celebrating? I don't know. It's America today. But if you go back 50 years, everybody knew why you were celebrating July 4th. Today in Canada, there's no understanding of Canadian history.
Correct. In America, the resistance to multiculturalism is still constitutional. So the America First people, they insisted that America will remain a republic based upon the founding values. And that current is still there. The America First argument was revived under Donald Trump. So long the American Bill of Rights is not abridged or altered through amendment, then those 10 amendments are the autoimmune in the American Constitution against multiculturalism.
Because if you want to see one politician, and you know this much better than me, Fred, if you want to see one politician who's riding high in the polls still and who's talking a lot about this, well, you look at America and you can see with the Republicans and the current polling that they are still actually holding together the post-2016 realignment. If you look at how strongly supportive working class voters are of Donald Trump. All the groups, by the way, that the British Tories have managed to alienate and lose over the last few years, certainly since 2019, the Republicans are actually in play. I mean, they've still got that realignment, and irrespective of how you feel about Donald Trump, they've done that partly by leaning into many of these cultural questions, by actually recognizing that voters want to have a conversation about the things that make them who they are, their history, their identity, their culture, what we teach our children. It doesn't take you long in the Tory movement to find somebody who's critical of Suella Braverman. I mean, what she's come out and said has actually been quite unpopular around the cabinet table. Why is that? Because they're status conscious Tories. I mean, they view cultural issues as being beneath them. They view issues around migration and integration and sex and gender and history and statues, you know, all this stuff is kind of, you know, lowbrow. It's not status driven politics.
Well, let me just give you a quote before we continue, Salim, from Braverman. She says, "I believe that the nation state is one of humanity's great civilizing forces. It creates a shared identity and a shared purpose, and that does not need to have a racial component." So in other words, she's recognizing, as you are, that multi-ethnic is fine. It is the way of the world. It is the way of humanity. Multicultural is different, and I think we've defined what we now mean by that.
Multiculturalism has normalized the cultures and ideologies that are entirely antithetical to the value of our founding culture, which is classical liberalism, which is freedom based upon individual rights.
So there's the standard, isn't it?
And that's the standard. That is the standard, but we have done away with that standard. Now, we can agree, and we do agree, you and I believe we do agree, that an individual has the right to do what he does without interfering with the rights of others. But how do you accept in a culture such as America and Canada, based on individual rights, a Nazi fascist culture, and say this is fine, we can coexist? Because this issue again came to a head in Ontario on the basis of multiculturalism, that the demand was there to have Sharia courts. And before anybody accuses me that I'm equating a Sharia court and Sharia law with Nazism, that's not what I'm doing. How are we going to reconcile all of these things? These are all of the problems that in effect, Suella Braverman is suggesting, because in England or in Great Britain, the issue of Sharia law has been supported by the Archbishops of Canterbury. It has been supported in the House of Lords. The only question is at what point of time the British government is going to recognize in the House of Commons and establish Sharia courts, which will then lead to establishing or appointing justices who are experts in Sharia law. But here we are with 338 members standing up and giving a standing ovation to a Nazi. And that is all right, because, you know, this is our parliament. The precedent has been established, as Prime Minister Trudeau is trying to squeeze himself out of this dilemma. He will, and given our memory as a people, which has basically a half-life of 10 seconds, is already history, you know? So the question is the normalization. The Western world has normalized Nazism, because we are in full embrace of the Ukrainian Nazis, supporting them with tens of billions of dollars. America has already invested over $100 billion and more is in the pipeline. All the European countries that at one time fell under the heels of goose-stepping Nazis are lined up behind Zelensky and supporting him. There are exceptions. Viktor Orban is, for instance, an exception. The man who has been re-elected as Prime Minister of Slovakia is an exception. But the exception proves the rule, that the European states are in full embrace of Nazism. And anybody who opposes Nazism now is therefore going to be prosecuted or can be prosecuted. But the story is even darker than the current story. In the case of Canada, we have talked about that we brought in Ukrainian Nazis into the country as part of the deal that was made by the Allied power, Britain and United States, when the war ended in 1945, through the Red Line to bring in Ukrainian Nazis. Specifically, I'm talking about Ukrainian Nazis. There were German Nazis that went through the Red Line into Latin America, people like Adolf Eichmann, you know, or Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon, etc., etc. The Ukrainian Nazis were brought to the Five I countries, as was Yaroslav Hunka, under the radar, silently complicit with the Western governments, that is the Allied powers, who rescued these people instead of handing them over to the Russians, to the Soviets, because they had committed war crimes against the Soviets and against the Poles and against the Jews. We brought them to use them in our future conflict with the Soviet Union, which was already germinating in terms of the Cold War. So among them, there were people like Peter Saverin, who was likely a comrade-in-arm in the Waffen-SS Galician division with Yaroslav Hunka. They were teenagers when they joined the Waffen-SS during the Second World War, and they came to Canada barely out of their teenage years in 1945, and they became Canadians. Nobody vetted them, nobody questioned them, to the extent that Peter Saverin became a lawyer in Canada, rose to become the Chancellor of University of Alberta, and was awarded the Order of Canada, where the story of the Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland's grandfather. He was not given the Order of Canada, but his granddaughter has become the Deputy Prime Minister and could become the Prime Minister. She has not disavowed Nazism.
I was going to say that we shouldn't necessarily ascribe to a person the sins of the father, but in Chrystia Freeland's case, we can.
You cannot be contaminated by what happened in the lives of our grandfather or even our father or mother, you know. The child is not to be held responsible for the action. Each individual is to be held responsible for their action, you know. But if I am running for public office and my grandfather was a Ukrainian Nazi working for SS Reichsfuhrer Heinrich Himmler, then it is not only very right of you as a voter, Robert Vaughan, but it is for the political party, for the country, to vet me and to ask me whether I have disavowed in every way the ideology, the culture, the values of what made my grandfather a deputy to SS Reichsfuhrer Heinrich Himmler. Has anybody done that with Chrystia Freeland? The answer is no. Even after this fact is an open public knowledge, no, even after the fact that she was in 2022, when the special military operation began in Ukraine, holding public rally in Canada, in Toronto, in Alberta, waving Stephen Bandera's flag, black and red, blood and soil. So that is the normalization process that has gone on. So we have normalized that. We have normalized Khalistanis. Our leader of opposition that is keeping the minority government of Justin Trudeau in government, Jagmeet Singh, as far as I know, cannot travel to India, will not be given a visa to travel to India for his association with the Khalistani movement that is at war with India, and that the members of the Khalistani movement were responsible for the murder of the Indian Prime Minister, Mrs. Indira Gandhi, and that subsequent to that murder of Mrs. Gandhi, the worst terrorist operation before 9/11 was planned, arranged, and executed by Khalistani members right out of Canada in bringing down an Air India 747 in 1985 with Indo-Canadians in the plane, over 350 passengers and crew. And these people are still moving around.
They only got the bomb maker, didn't they?
Oh, yes. But before the bombing was done, criminal activity, terrorist activity was carried out. Before the Prime Minister of India was killed, the Indian government was informing, asking, warning the Canadian government to be aware of the activity of the Khalistanis, because Canada had become the base of operation. So we did not give order of Canada to Jagmeet Singh as we gave order of Canada to Peter Saverin, but we have normalized this entire anti-Canadian value, if we had a value, which we did, freedom based on individual rights, common law, and so on. But that's all gone off the board. That is the ultimate effect of multiculturalism for us, for England, as Suella Braverman says, for Germany, as Angela Merkel has said, and so on and so forth. The normalization of fascism.
Yes. Suella Braverman, as you recall in the quote that I said that we have to be fearless in calling this out, the policy of multiculturalism. And I think that you are fearless. And thank you for your comments. And thank you for your book, Delectable Lie. Thank you, Salim. Fascinating.
Thank you.
Consider the intentional hypocrisy and contradictions in a country that embraces Nazism and fascism, an ideology of the left, and then accuses anyone on the right of being fascist. And while many on the right refute that accusation, they consistently fail to identify and define what the right truly is. And as Salim said, when you cannot define something, it has no identity. In the same way, the right has failed to define itself in a way that is just right. So they're always left with the left. Which explains why there is a show called Just Right, and why you are invited to join us again next week, when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Being an MP is a vast, subsidized ego trip. It's a job for which you need no qualifications, there are no compulsory hours of work, no performance standards. You get a warm room and subsidised meals for a bunch of self-opinionated windbags and busybodies. suddenly find people taking them seriously because they've got the letters MP after their names.